Hola Capital Region, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary of Independent Media in Troy. I'm Tatiana Morani.
And I'm Dan Pfeiffer. Today we are starting off the show talking about money. WOOC correspondent Mark Dunley spoke to Ron Deutsch at the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus about Governor Cuomo's proposed budget.
Then WOOC correspondent Melissa Bromley interviewed volunteers at WAYO radio station in Rochester, New York.
Afterwards, me and correspondent Aaron Pedinati will talk data justice. Later in the show, I got a chance to sit with Arizona State Professor Daniel Gilfillan about non-human creativity.
And we'll close the show with a visit from our favorite Stanley Hatzell from Market Block Books. Stanley's going to bring you a stack of great reads, but first, headlines.
Senator James Ted Disco of Schenectady is planning to introduce legislation that creates a new Guardians for Schools license plate. Sales of the license plate would fund armed school resource officers, enhanced mental health screenings and counseling, security cameras, and other building modifications that may be needed, as well as active shooter and other security trainings to New York State schools to improve school safety. The New York State Sheriff's Association has called for the funding of armed school resource officers at every school in the state. Last year, the New York State Senate passed legislation to have a police officer stationed at every New York City school, and legislation is pending to have armed school resource officers at all upstate schools.
The Daily News reported a coalition of gun control advocates and state lawmakers are urging the legislature to quickly pass legislation that would make it easier to keep firearms away from dangerous individuals. They are pushing a bill to give judges the power to issue extreme risk protection orders that would block individuals considered likely to harm themselves or others from possessing or purchasing guns. This measure passed the Assembly last year, but was blocked in the Republican-controlled Senate.
The public is invited to comment on an amended remedy proposed by the Department of Environmental Conservation. The hearing is related to the Perfection plating site located at 911 11th Street in Watervliet. Beginning in 1965, the facility electroplated copper, nickel, as well as zinc and cadmium. The planting operation was shut down in September of 1990. The chromic acid tank inside the building was of particular concern because it leaked and significantly contaminated the groundwater under the building. The public hearing will take place on March 7th at 7 p.m. in the Watervliet Senior Center. 19 New York Army National Guard soldiers from the Glenville Center are being sent for an estimated 9-month deployment to Afghanistan. The soldiers are a headquarters unit which will control and support several companies in charge of disposing of bombs or improvised explosive devices. The Afghanistan conflict has become more dangerous as the Islamic State has established a foothold in the country. President Trump is seeking to increase military pressure on the Taliban to force them into peace talks.
Two Manhattan state senators have introduced a bill for a statewide ban on single-use plastic bags. Cuomo and the state legislator last year blocked a plastic law in New York City from taking effect, but Cuomo promised to propose a statewide approach to the issue. The bill by Senator Krueger and Holliman resembles the California plastic bag ban law. It would bar the use of most plastic bags and charge a fee of at least 10 cents per paper and reusable bags. Some of the money would be kept by retailers to cover their cost, and 80% would be disposed in the state's fund for environmental projects.
The Supreme Court on Monday heard a challenge to an Illinois law that allows government employee unions such as AFSCME to collect fees from workers who choose not to join. The unions say that the outcome could affect more than 5 million government workers in 24 states and the District of Columbia. The court split 4-4 the last time it considered the issue in 2016. A Trump appointee has joined the court since then. The public employee unions say it would be much harder to operate if not all workers they represent at a worksite are required to pay dues.
The City of Troy is hosting a series of neighborhood meetings to hear feedback about a recent comprehensive plan that has garnered criticism for neglecting to consider long-standing businesses and schools to the long-vacant Monument Square lot. The next meeting will take place at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, February 27th at 2247 13th Street in Troy.
Politico reported children's welfare advocates are describing Governor Cuomo's executive budget as one of the most harmful financial proposals for kids in decades. The governor, looking to close a $4.4 billion budget gap, has proposed delaying a promised Medicaid reform that children's health professionals say could do lasting damage to the state's mostly medically and emotionally fragile kids. The budget proposal also caps New York City's allotment for preventative child welfare services and eliminates funding for the Close to Home program, which seeks to keep teens out of the adult criminal justice system.
Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace demonstrated today against the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay. Correspondent John Flanders got the scoop.
Yeah, this is John Flanders for WOOC-FM. I'm here in Del Mar with Trudy Quay from Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace. Trudy, why are you picketing today?
Well, we've been here every Monday from 5 to 6 having a vigil for peace and justice. Tonight, the theme of our vigil is Close Guantanamo Bay Prison.
And what do you hope to achieve with this particular subject as far as Guantanamo's concerned, aside from closing it?
Well, we'd like to make our community aware that Trump's plan is to not only to keep it open, to fill it up again. I think there's only about maybe 40 prisoners there right now, but Trump's hoping to fill it up. I think there's maybe 1,800 U.S. employees at the prison just waiting for some new inmates. They've got a whole new hospital. They're ready to go. So we want people to know that Guantanamo Bay should have been closed a long time ago. The people, at least half of the prisoners there right now have been cleared for release, but Trump refused to release them. So we want people to know that this is not right. These people have done nothing wrong. It's time to close Guantanamo Bay and send these prisoners back home.
Okay, and how can people learn more about this? What resources do you recommend?
Well, there's the United National Anti-War Coalition has a website. There's quite a bit of information on there. I guess that would probably be the best source I can think of. There's a lot of different sources. Google it.
Okay. And also, how can you get involved in these weekly pickets that you do here in Del Mar?
Well, we welcome new people anytime. We're here every Monday night from 5 to 6 p.m. at the Four Corners in Del Mar. It's at the corner of Kenwood and Delaware Avenue. We've been doing this for 15 years. We're here at least 50 weeks out of the year.
This is John Flanders for WOC. I've been interviewing Trudy Quay from Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace. Do you have a website, Trudy?
We do. www.bethlehemforpeace.org. You can go to our website. You can get on our weekly email list. We put out a weekly email where we list all the local peace and justice events and lots of other information, different websites and so forth.
Thank you, Trudy. John Flanders out.
Wow, those were some headlines. Many big things are going on. We have something big as well. Can we get a drum roll?
I don't know if you have a drum roll.
We're trying to get a drum roll. There we go. There's our drum roll. Today, we are introducing listener texting. We want you to tell us what you think of our show, about the headlines, topics we cover, everything.
So listen carefully. All you do is text a number and then send what you have to say in the body of the text. You can include your name or not. It really doesn't matter. So the phone number is 518-888, so 3804. I'm going to say it again. It's 518-888-3004. So hit us up, send us a text, tell us what you think of our show.
But don't text and drive. Remember, you can stream our station live 24/7 online by visiting our website, mediasanctuary.org. First, on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, WOOC caught up with Ron Deutsch at the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus Conference to discuss the state of the governor's proposed budget.
We're talking with Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute. The governor put out his 30-day budget amendments last week. We now have 6 weeks or so before the final budget deadline, allegedly of April 1st. How is the budget shaping up, and you know, what are likely to be some of the big flashpoints in the next few weeks?
So I think the budget is taking shape right now, and the governor has really been focused, I think, primarily on mitigating the harm that's facing New York as a result of the federal tax reforms that were put in place. So one of the biggest things that the governor is concerned about, as he points out, you know, the federal government and the GOP shot a missile at the heart of New York, he says. And that really, what he's talking about is the limitation on the state and local tax deduction. So normally, and for the past, since the inception of the federal income tax, we've been able to deduct all of our state and local income and or property taxes on our federal tax returns. That helps lower the tax liability here in New York in the sense that you're able to write it off of your income level. So that reduces your tax liability. So right now, there's a limitation of $10,000. So while this obviously affects, you know, middle, upper, and wealthy individuals more than anybody else, and it obviously only affects people who are itemizing on their tax returns, this is going to cost New Yorkers potentially about $14 billion at a time when we're already giving the federal government about $40 to $48 billion a year more than we get back in services. So the governor's come up with a number of proposals right now. One is to basically do a swap between the payroll tax and income tax. So now he's got a plan in the 30-day amendments that would do something similar to that, but it would maintain the personal income tax, and it would be an opt-in plan. So employers would be allowed to opt into it as a way to help their employees, mitigate their increase in taxes as a result of the SALT limitations. So that's one of the plans he has in place, and that's revenue neutral. The other plan that he's pushing forward that we're pretty concerned with is this notion of setting up charitable organizations in order to fund public services. So he's saying he would set up two large charitable funds at the state level, one for education, one for healthcare, which are kind of the two biggest expenditures in our state budget. They make up half of our budget outlays. And he would also look to do this at the local level, where local governments could set up funds, charitable funds, and local school districts could set up charitable funds in order to take what we would call donations so that they can be written off on people's taxes. So, you know, whether or not that's a good idea obviously remains to be seen. We're not very enamored by it. We think it sets up a situation where we would have unpredictable funding levels for a variety of different public services. And I think it also opens the door to what many of us have been fighting for years now that the governor has proposed and supported, is this notion of being able to provide a donation to your private school or parochial school or charter school. And, you know, we'd be nervous that funds would be set up for that as well, and that would divert money away from our public school system.
Now, many years ago, the courts had ordered the state to increase education funding to resolve some of the disparities that rural schools and inner city schools are doing. Advocates claim that the state has basically stolen billions of dollars despite that court order. Does this budget really, you know, sort of resolve those education funding issues?
No, it doesn't even come close to doing that. I mean, the budget seeks to invest about another $169 million into education this year. The governor says that's a 3% increase. But the reality is less than half of that is going towards foundation aid and would be counted toward meeting the CFE requirements or Campaign for Fiscal Equity lawsuit requirements you just talked about. So we're still about $3.9 billion short on meeting that commitment to providing a sound basic education across New York State. And the reality is that we need to invest more, in particular, in schools that are struggling across New York, what we would call now priority schools. The governor started off calling them failing schools. So when we looked at those schools, we realized that there are common characteristics here. 9 out of 10 of the students in these schools are children of color. 83% come from disadvantaged families. 78% are in free and reduced price school lunch. So the reality is this isn't an education problem as much as it is a poverty problem. And we know that areas with significantly high child poverty rates also have significantly lower graduation rates than the state average. So we need to make sure that we are focused on providing funding to those schools and lifting people from the bottom up.
Well, speaking of poverty, one of the big issues remains affordable housing, and particularly the issue of homelessness, as homelessness has increased statewide, but particularly in New York City. And I know there has also been efforts by, I believe, Assemblymember Hevesy to deal with the low level of payments for housing for welfare participants. Are we making any progress in terms of what the governor's put on the table with respect to the affordable housing crisis?
You know, I think the governor has suggested that we'd be allocating in some $20 billion over the next number of years to address the housing affordability crisis here in New York. But clearly that money's not moving out the door. What we're seeing is a significant increase in the number of homeless people in New York City and across the state. We have some 88,000 people who are officially homeless based on the shelter counts that have been done. So we need to do a lot more, and we need to do a lot more right now. So I think what we need to be doing is really supporting things like Assemblyman Hevesy's home stability support program that would provide housing to homeless individuals or prevent people from being evicted. So there's a lot of things that we can do that we're not doing right now. And I think what we need to do is go after the resources and the revenues to make sure we can address some of these issues. So you have a situation in New York where we have the greatest income inequality of any state in the nation. And we also have some of the greatest needs of any state in the nation. So, again, with 88,000 homeless individuals, if that wasn't bad enough, many of our upstate cities and many areas in New York City have child poverty rates that are hovering around 50%. So half the children living in poverty. We have children who are living in food insecure households as well. So we need to do a lot more, and we need more of a bottom-up economic development strategy rather than this kind of trickle-down or top-down strategy that we have right now.
So what's the best way for our listeners to keep abreast of what's going on with the state budget? Target date, as always, is April 1st.
So certainly you can look at our website. We'll have a lot of information up there about the state budget. We just did an analysis of the governor's executive budget proposal, which can be found at fiscalpolicy.org.
Thank you, Ron Deutsch.
That was WOOC correspondent Mark Dunley talking to Ron Deutsch of the Fiscal Policy Institute about the governor's proposed budget. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM.
WOOC correspondent Melissa Bromley visited the WAYO radio station in Rochester, New York. WAYO is a freeform, low-power radio station that focuses on art and cultural programming. The volunteer staff sat down with Melissa to explain what motivates them to be a part of WAYO.
Well, it's sort of a concentric circle of volunteers because ultimately it leads to about 200 programmers who are also volunteers as well. So it's a huge team and it's a huge effort to sustain the station. Yeah. What's a dream come true, you know? Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I'd say it's a very much there's times when you sort of like pinch yourself. It's like, oh my gosh, driving down the street, and it's like, this is a radio station that has 200 plus people involved, all in the Rochester community, that you can go out to like all these different parts of the community and find somebody who is either, you know, has a show on WAO, know somebody who has a show on WAO, or has listened to WAO and is like, this is so cool that this is radio, this is what radio can be. So had those sort of like pinch yourself moments, and that, and walking into the studio and seeing people just doing their thing, and then the next show comes in and just keeps on going, is just incredible.
Yeah, it's interesting just because it's a never-ending list of projects. I mean, it's cool that we built this thing and it's essentially tangible at this point, but there's always here something that needs changing or improving or fixing. And it's fun to work on it, and it's fun to work with these people. I think that's why I do it so much.
It's magic, and who doesn't want to be around for magic?
And mostly what you guys are doing is arts and cultural programming. So was that a decision that was made, or just sort of an organic bubbling up of programming and creativity? And
I think it was based in part on the aspirational figures for why I wanted to do this. WFMU in Jersey City, New Jersey was a huge, huge inspiration for me. I think it's kind of natural that you make decisions informed by your idols. And then when you're rolling, you start to make decisions for yourself. But those early decisions of, okay, a broad arts and cultural focus just always seemed to be the natural fit for what I wanted to do, what I thought we could pull off. And with five other stations that started in Rochester around the same time of us, I think it also helped to differentiate what we were doing from what other people were doing.
And you guys are also pretty well known, and maybe getting even more well known for the technology that you've put in place here. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you came to be able to do that, and what is different here than at other low-power FM stations that are just getting started?
Jarrett and I both had experience at our college radio station. We both were involved at WITR, RIT's radio station. And the things that sort of motivate a lot of the projects we do are making it either easier for the people that are involved, allowing more access, and then also...
easier for us.
Well, yeah, easier for us. I mean, being all volunteer, the amount of time that we can put towards this, or being able to answer those phone calls at 3 in the morning, or having to answer phone calls at 3 in the morning because of this certain thing that people can't remember, well, let's fix that by, you know, inventing this tool or this notification or something. Yeah.
Sure. No, that sort of sums it up. You're right. It's tough to manage a station when you can't be there, and so if it can be managed remotely or automatically, then that's really what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Add that Jarrett and I both have sort of experiences that lend themselves well to like radio, especially today, because it's not just about like electrical stuff and wiring stuff together, but nowadays it's about like software and internet streaming and, you know, making sure that all 200 plus people can get into the studio, and we know who's coming in and coming out, and being able to keep track of things. And so our experiences, I think, lend well to making that happen.
Definitely. It's very impressive here to experience the FOB system that you have that helps keep track of the individuals who are coming and going, but also helps log into computers and automatically shares which DJ played which song at which time. It's very cool.
Thanks.
Is there anything that you have learned since you guys have been on the air for 2 years now, right, that you would want to share with the WOC community and our listeners?
What lessons have we learned? I think we have tried to make a space people want to be in, to make an organization people wanted to be a part of, to build trust between ourselves and the programmers. And it all kind of revolves around that, especially as a volunteer organization. As Jared said, we can't be here all the time, and the glue that holds it together really is that trust, that we don't have to micromanage people or always be on the lookout, because we trust them to do their shows and do them within the few legal constraints that we have and to do the great jobs that they do.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I would just say, you know, if you're starting a station or any organization, I guess never underestimate. I guess when you're like planning for, you know, because we sat down and tried to plan, like, okay, these are the guidebook for all of our programmers and programs and whatever, and these are the rules. And never, I guess, underestimate how that can change, and make sure to be able to adapt for that. Rules such as no reptiles in the broadcast studio, which happened and we didn't think we'd have to account for, but now we, you know,
So it sounds like you're learning every day. Yes. And adjusting and learning how to maybe just be agile.
Yep.
With the process. Thank you guys so much for having us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was correspondent Melissa Bromley visiting WAYO radio station in Rochester, New York. WOOC is also a volunteer-run radio station. Me and my co-host and our engineer and all of our producers are volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering, WOOC would love to have you. Send us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or come by one of our weekly meetings held every Monday night here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media.
Fellow WOOC correspondent Aaron Pettinati invited me into the studio to discuss data justice and open source mapping software. This is part two of that interview.
Dan Pfeiffer, a Troy resident and artist, educator, and software developer interested in data justice. He is a co-founder of the Small Data Collective, creating new online spaces as public goods. He's also an entrepreneur in residence at Civic Hall in New York City, has a computer science degree from Harvey Mudd College and a master's from NYU's Interactive Telecommunications Program. Last week, I interviewed Dan about MapZen, an open mapping company at which he was recently employed. Today, we're going to talk about Dan's interest in data justice and civic technology. Dan, thanks for sitting down for this interview today. I'm really looking forward to talking to you about data justice activism.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
To start out, I'm hoping you can unpack this term for us. What is data justice?
I guess I don't know that I have a really good pithy definition of data justice. It does seem to combine a lot of other social justice issues together and use them as a frame for thinking about technology. So thinking about who has access to create the technologies that we use every day, what kinds of various social issues are embedded in the technologies as they're being created, how do we feel about the relationship between large corporations that are harvesting all this data about us? How do we feel about like their privacy policies? What kind of society are we allowing the likes of Elon Musk to build on our behalf? I mean, so these are kind of like a lot of the things I'm thinking about when I say data justice. I'm not sure if you say data or data.
But I think it's either or.
I think so.
So the idea here is that data itself is political, and that technologies are expressions of social factors, social forces, social dynamics, that they have power built into them, and that we should be aware of that power, and that we should be addressing it.
I think that's my pithy definition that I was looking for, yes.
Okay. So did MapZen, the open mapping company of which you were part, have a data justice orientation in any of its projects?
It wasn't overt. I mean, we were, you know, as an open source, open data company, that was sort of like a whole part of our thing to start with. I think we were a little, as a corporation, you know, we were actually owned by Samsung, which is like one of the biggest, least concerned with justice. I don't know. I shouldn't say this. I mean, Samsung has a lot of problems with how it's how it conducts itself. MapZen was a really righteous place to work. I loved everyone that was there. Our CEO was fantastic on a lot of these issues. As an organization, though, I'm not sure that we could claim any high ground on data justice or any other kind of justice. I mean, we were ultimately a company making good products that happened to be less abusive to the end users. But beyond that, I'm not sure we could claim to be like a data justice company per se.
Okay, so for you, data justice is something that you're kind of doing more as a side project, something that you're interested in at a personal level.
Yes, and there was, so when I was at MapZen, there was an instance where we discussed how to handle an abuse of our terms of service. Someone had this like overtly racist project. I'm not going to name it because I don't want to give it attention, but it was using our services and we were trying to suss out how to deal with that. So we did shut his API key off. I think we did the right thing there. And then later on, we had a similar kinds of discussion around how to handle the Trump administration and how to handle uses of our services that, you know, might be, you know, against the inherent goodness we were trying to put out into the world. And I'm more ambivalent about the latter case than the former case, in part because I feel like, I'm someone who is very politically active, and I do think that it's important for people to use their leverage within organizations, especially tech workers, to do what they can to do the right thing in the world. But on the other hand, like, government services are still like a vital part of almost all of us rely on some aspect of government services. So I didn't like the idea of targeting the public sector by and large, or, you know, preemptively cutting them off before they did the thing we were anticipating. So during that discussion, I was happy to be just someone doing activism, going to protests, and then going to work and keeping the two things kind of separate.
Well, I think that it speaks well of the company that there was a collective concern about these issues in the first place. It'd be nice if larger media companies, for instance, Twitter, were addressing some of these issues. But from what I've read about your work, you have civic technology side projects of your own. Can you explain what civic technology is in the first place and unpack its relationship to the idea of data justice?
I mean, similarly with defining data justice, I'm not sure I have a great civic technology definition. I mean, but my idea of civic tech is you're using your tech capabilities to promote some like civic good that you want to see more of in the world. And I mean, for me, a lot of what that entails is like civic engagement through cartography is one of them. And so the fact that I worked at MapZen is useful in that way. So like, for example, there's a data set that I'm really interested in working with that the EPA puts out. The New York Times just based an article on it, actually. It's the Toxic Release Index, and it has about 80,000 specific instances of where companies are known to have polluted the environment. And they're latitude, longitude encoded. They describe exactly what kind of pollution was involved, and they name names. You know, it tells you exactly who's responsible for it. As a list of, you know, it's like an Excel spreadsheet, basically. And in this form of a long list, it's not very useful to individuals. But if you map it, if you like put the points on the map and you see where the ones that are close to you are, you might think about it differently, and you might, you know, organize around that as a environmental issue.
Okay, so civic technology projects are sort of civic activism with a technological inflection.
Yeah, activism is a component, but I think it should also be understood to include more straightforward operational things. So, you know, there's civic tech applications where maybe you just want to like connect representatives to their constituents with fewer of the, you know, the less of the advocacy aspect to it.
So can you tell us a little bit about the specific civic technology projects that you've worked on?
Yeah, I mean, the one that I'm putting most of my energy into now is called Small Data. And Small Data is It's a little bit hard to describe, but it's a set of software prototypes that I'm building that are designed in a certain way. They're designed to be simple, easy to operate, and they don't do all that many things. Like, they're very kind of narrowly focused. So I have one that lets you create and edit maps, and another one that lets you set up a chat room for your friends. And the thing that these things are meant to do is, like, operate easily in an offline setting. So if you happen to be, like, out in the desert or in the Catskills where there's no internet connectivity, these things will work well. Or an airplane, you know. There's lots of situations where there's no internet. But the more interesting situations for me are the places where the mainstream services are censored or blocked by government firewalls, and creating technologies that are accommodating to those situations, I think, is interesting. So that's one of the parts of it. The other parts are, like, I want it to be a worker co-op, and I want to train people on how to operate the software. So it's kind of like a bunch of things at once, but it's all under this heading of small data.
So how does that idea of small data contrast with big data specifically?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, right. The name is certainly a play on the idea of big data, and it's definitely in opposition to it. I mean, the promise of big data, as far as I understand it, is if I'm a company that's gathering up all the data and housing it, I'm able to make these, like, magical assertions using fancy software and, you know, like, what is it? Analytica, what is that company?
Analytica Britannica, something along those lines.
Yeah, Analytica Britannica is a famous case of this that was used in the 2016 election in order to help target advertising. Small data is kind of the reverse. It's like I'm interested in, instead of gathering every bit of data about everybody, just gathering all of my data and having more responsibility for it, having more capacity to archive it, inspect it, maybe decide to delete some of it that I don't want around, or encrypt it, or hide it from people. So that's the idea with small data, is like trying to bring it closer into my own sphere of influence.
And take a little bit of responsibility for your own online digital data trail.
Yeah, I mean, I This is a tricky thing for me. I'm interested in everyone deactivating Facebook, but on the other hand, Facebook is where a lot of organizing happens. And this is the kind of, how much should you disengage? How much should you use what's there already? And it's something that I kind of skirt the issue a little bit. I did deactivate my Facebook, and then I created a new one with a fake name. And this is like, this is my compromise.
Right. And if everybody did that, it would just be fake Facebook, right?
Right.
So
yeah,
it's a complicated double-edged sword with regard to a lot of these questions. So lastly, can you give us a specific sense of how data justice might be relevant to the Capital Region in particular, as a resident of the Capital Region?
Yes. I mean, I think the easy examples probably have to do with uncovering corruption in state government. I have a friend who does automated data journalism. And a lot of that's like looking through funding for politicians and making sure that the sources of funding are legit, and that, like, just using some basic models to try to find the places where corruption is happening.
Yes, and that is certainly a big issue in New York State and the Capital Region in particular right now. So thanks very much for this interview, Dan. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you. That was me and correspondent Aaron Perinati talking about open source mapping. You can visit my website at pfeiffer.org to learn more, and that's spelled pfeiffer.org.
For those just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. I'm Tatiana Morani.
And I'm Dan Pfeiffer. If you're on the move, you can stream WOOC live 24/7 by visiting mediasanctuary.org. Also, let us know what you think about the show. Just send us a text to 518-888-3004. That's 518-888-3004. On Saturday, I was in Tempe, Arizona for a graduate student conference called the Posthuman Network. I had a chance to chat with Dr. Daniel Gilfillan about art and non-human agency in parrots.
My first book publication was on sort of a cultural history of experimentation with the radio medium, the role of radio art or sound art, and a number of the people whose work I explore are sound artists and what they're trying to do with sound as a perceptual modality, but also as a medium that carries communication along with it. I am currently working on a book on sound in the Anthropocene, trying to get at a way to maybe a different vector for thinking about this quote-unquote new period of geological time. Within the realm of the humanities, at least, the term has taken on somewhat of a life of its own, thinking metaphorically, that brings together questions surrounding environmental studies, sustainability, what is being called the environmental humanities, and helping us to think a bit differently about our meaning humans' position within sort of the world, as whether or not we can be the central agents for change, or whether we need to expand that idea of agency to include other types of agents that we often take for granted as being sort of support people for the humans. So we can think of animals and plants as sort of logical extensions from a notion of human agency to non-human agency. But I also think we need to think about geologies, rock formations, atmospheres, because all of these things affect acoustics in various ways. For me, there's a big conceit to this idea of the Anthropocene, that we locate ourselves in the exact center of the definition, where the cause is, but in many respects, people think that we'll be the sole engineers of the solutions for the Anthropocene. And the sound artists that I'm looking at are trying to problematize that a little bit. A group of sound artists who work together, they're independent sound artists, but they have a collaborative group called Alien Productions. They're based in Vienna. And they began a project in 2012 called Metamusic, in which they, I don't know how they got on this idea, but how do you resolve the issue of boredom in zoo animals? And can sound provide a way to engage animals who are in captivity in ways that we might not have thought about before? So can zoologists, zookeepers, bring sound into play into that activity that they provide to the animals that are there? And they began some initial testing of use of musical instruments with animals and thinking about animal musicality. And they were approached by an animal biologist who works with a group of rescued African gray parrots. There's a society for rescued African gray parrots outside of Vienna, and they bring with them a large set of needs. They need a lot of space. They need a lot of attention. They need a lot of interaction, human or otherwise. Ideally, they have a partner bird. They don't like to be alone. They're very social animals. And so a lot of people either give them up to these shelters because they didn't realize how much work they were. They're too loud, too noisy. They keep waking me up, those kinds of things. Or this shelter also rescues parrots that have been abused and rehabilitates them. The artists decided to see if they could work with the African greys. Irene Pepperberg is an animal cognition specialist and has worked with African grey parrots. One in particular who she worked with for a couple of decades. And her work shows that as they develop, they can have the cognition ability of a four-year-old child. They also outlive the human species. They have a longer lifespan than most humans. And so they felt that they might be the right animal group to work with musical instruments. So they began adapting children's musical instruments like Fisher-Price keyboards and electric guitars to see if these birds would interact with them. Thank you. they receive some interaction. They also use triggering. They have sound trigger devices, so any kind of connection between the bird and the instrument gets picked up, and then they use an algorithm to turn that into sound, and then they would compose with it. But as the project developed, they caught the interest of the School for Interface Design at the University of Arts and Design in Linz, and that group received a 3-year Austrian Science Foundation grant to examine how they might produce instruments that are more parrot-centric and less human-centric, so moving away from this idea of an adapted child's instrument and looking more at the biosemiotic patterns of the birds themselves and what they'd like to interact with in their sort of native or shelter environment, the types of things that they do with their beaks, with their claws, and adapting along those lines. And so the instruments are moving more into the kinds of things that evoke the parrot's curiosity versus the kinds of things that evoke humans' curiosity. And as I've been sort of observing this project over the last couple of years, I've noticed that this is this idea of curiosity that is the thing that connects the parrots and the humans. And they had a 3-month long museum installation with 21 parrots, primarily African greys. There are a couple of Amazon parrots in there too. And over that 3-month period, so they built a very large aviary space on the roof of the museum in Linz, and the birds lived outdoors, had some shelter if it was too cold. They were visited daily by the populace of Linz, and so while I was there just for a week, and what I noticed was that there's a lot of moments of play that occurs between the encounter between humans and parrots, a lot of mimicry on the part of the humans, less so on the part of the parrots. That idea of play and mutual curiosity, I think, is that, for me, is that bridge between the performance of agency, in a way. And sound helps bring that about. Back in March of 2004, the European Space Agency launched a space probe to travel to the to Jupiter. To their mission was to soft land a spacecraft onto one of the orbiting comets of Jupiter. And in August of 2014, as they were approaching the comet, they picked up a whole range of low frequency electromagnetic waves. And upon transposing it so that they were audible for human reception, discovered that it was actually producing a song of sorts. And just that for me, that's an example for a lot of people to kind of contemplate what is inaudible to our species, and that what exists in the realm of the inaudible, we don't lend any weight to. Unless we are scientists or are capable of transposing those waves, or artists who do that quite often as well. And it kind of puts into stark relief some of the larger questions around, well, if we don't hear it, it doesn't exist, right? Or if we don't see it, then it has no impact on what my life is like, right?
It's interesting to think of sound as a space that we share with each other and with other kinds of creatures. Mm-hmm. What are some ways that we should be listening to our non-human neighbors?
I think in the for example with these parrots, it's about slowing down. It's about using the technology to bring us into the space of curiosity, and then maybe not connecting only through the technology, but through that idea of play.
That was Professor Dan Giffelin talking about sound, art, and parrots. To learn more about Alien Productions' MetaMusic project, visit metamusic.at. Stanley Hatzel of Market Block Books is back in the studio once again. Hello, Stanley. Glad to have you, as always.
Hello. Thank you.
So, what do you have for us today?
I have probably way too many books, so I'm going to dive in with an old favorite because there's a sequel to this old favorite. The old favorite is called My Name is Mary Sutter by Robin Oliveira. This is a novel that is set in Albany, New York, or starts in Albany, New York, right around the time of the Civil War. And Mary Sutter wants to become a doctor, but the Albany School of Medicine will not take her.
Why not?
Because she's a woman.
Aww.
I know. So she does, you know, she's a midwife and does things like that and helps a lot of people. But what I love about it, it gives you this real strong feel of Albany in the 1800s. And in the area where I used to live, or near the on Dove Street, it just is a great story. And she ends up going down into the battle scenes in the Civil War. Outside, she first goes to Washington, D.C., where there's this hospital, and they keep amputating limbs, and there's like this pile of limbs outside one window.
That sounds
gross. And so she's assisting and helping, and it's pretty intense. And then she ends up in the middle of a nighttime battle where she gets off a train and she starts walking and doesn't realize she's walking among all these dead soldiers. So it's a powerful, powerful book and beautiful. And it's got a great sense of history. The woman, the author, is originally from this area, now lives on the West Coast, but she gives a terrific feel for the area. So the second book, which I haven't read yet, but I am ready to read it, is just comes out tomorrow. So you're getting the first peek at this new release called Winter Sisters. Also, it's a follow-up to My Name is Mary Sutter. Honestly, I know it's going to be good. So,
I feel like the name Sutter is something I see on place names a lot. Is it the same family name, or is this just like a fictitious?
I think it's just fictional.
Yeah.
I don't know for sure. I hadn't thought about that. Sutter's out in the West Coast, but that's a California name,
yes.
I think.
I grew up in California, and so there's a place called Sutter's Mill that
right.
sticks out in my mind.
Right. Well, I don't think so. But maybe she's inspired by the West Coast, because that's where she lives. Although I think she's like Seattle or someplace, not California. So honestly, My Name is Mary Sutter is one of my favorite recommends, and then pretty soon I'm going to have a second recommend going on once I get this read. So that's on my agenda.
Did we say the name already? It's Winter.
It's called Winter's Sisters. And I have a synopsis of the book, but I don't even want to tell you the synopsis. I want you to read that first one first if you hadn't read it. So the next book I brought, this is actually a memoir. It came out last Tuesday, so it's still within a week of release. It's called Educated, and it's by Tara Westover. This is an unbelievable story. This woman grew up in a survivalist cult, Mormon survivalist cult in Idaho. Parents, you know, kept them home, raised them. Mother's an herbalist. Dad is a bunch of different things, you know, construction, you know, whatever. And he's the patriarch of the family. And one of her brothers is abusive, but one of the brothers of the family managed to escape and go off to college, and he comes back and says, you can go off to college too. So she ends up passing the ACT, gets admitted to Brigham Young University, and from there, she knew nothing. She didn't even know what the Holocaust was. She knew nothing about anything. She was trying to read Les Miserables, and she didn't know who Napoleon Bonaparte was. So she,
oh my,
she had this obvious lack in her education. But she gets into Brigham Young. From there, she goes to Harvard, and she gets her PhD from Cambridge University in England. So this is an amazing coming of age story. And she didn't know how to write, so she taught herself how to write. She actually taught herself grammar and mathematics so she could take the ACT.
Oh, my gosh.
That's
so impressive.
Her writing is really brilliant, riveting. You can't stop turning the pages. It's just a terrific, terrific book. It's called Educated by Tara Westover.
Is it a true story? It can't be a true story.
True story. It's
oh
a
my
true
goodness.
Story, and that's what makes it even more amazing. Yeah.
And I can barely figure out how to make rice without it being too sticky or too much water.
So I kind of wanted – my idea with these books is that they would how to feed yourself. You know, so she fed herself with knowledge. And Mary Sutter's story is about feeding her spirit but also end up feeding other people and taking care of other folks. So the next part is more literal. So I brought some gardening books. I live in a tiny, tiny apartment that happened to have a backyard, and I can't grow much at all. So the first thing I brought is called Indoor Kitchen Gardening, Turn Your Home into a Year-Round Vegetable Garden by Elizabeth Millard or Millard. Simple ideas for someone who's not as talented at gardening like me.
Me too.
And things like growing stuff on the windowsill in a, like a flower box, a hanging thing. I have a similar book that I'm going to show you. It's like this one as well, but a little bit larger scale. But, you know, using pots, flower pots, all kinds of things.
I'm looking at page 25, and there's an adorable picture of a cat eating a plant. So it's not just for humans.
That's right. You can't plants. Cats need plants, too. So I don't have any.
That's part of my problem. I put plants out there, and my cat will eat them. Even I got a cactus, and then she just started attacking it.
Well, you should plant something for your cat.
She thinks I do.
So similarly, this next book is called The Indoor Edible Garden. You see the theme here already. It's they're thinking small. It's a larger book than the one I just showed you. And this one has many more ideas and projects. Some of them are absolutely things that I know I could pull off. Some of them would take a coach and a team to cheer me on for that.
Yeah, like these sprouts, which are supposed to be really, really easy to do.
Well, I wish I brought my sprout book, because sprouts really are very easy. You just need a mason jar and a little mesh top. And you soak your seeds and then drain them and let the light grow them out. It's amazingly simple, and they're so good for you. So the next book is one of these teeny tiny books called Growing a Permaculture Food Forest. Now this is really my kind of gardening, because you don't have to worry about doing anything fancy. And look how tiny this book is. I don't even think it's 50 pages long, maybe. But this guy goes through all the details, this permaculture food forest, about how you can just easily plant things. And what you're doing is you're planting something that's going to continually grow back over and over and over again and sustain itself. And so you have to monitor it the first couple of years to make sure it's getting properly, what's that word you want? Grounded, rooted?
I don't know anything about growing plants, but I like this approach to a small and very approachable book.
It's very direct. There's no questions about what you're doing with this book. And if you don't have a garden in your backyard, see if you can borrow some of your neighbor's space, with the idea you might give the neighbor some of your produce.
Nice. It's, well, we got one more minute left, Stanley. So
one more minute, and the last book is going to be the Big Ideas for Small Places, another gardening book. This one is a little bit more involved, but there are some really clever ideas about using wooden crates to hang things, and there are some vegetables and produce in there I've never heard of before. One that looks like a little watermelon, but apparently tastes like a cucumber, and I can't even tell you what the word is. I've never heard this word, but it's good. So there's a lot in there.
Perfect timing, right before spring starts.
That's right.
Well, guys, that concludes our show. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Once again, I'm Tatiana Morani.
And I'm Dan Pfeiffer. Don't forget to give us your feedback by texting 518-888-3004. Tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. for more local news and views.
Thanks for tuning in.